This is Peter Fisher, and I'd like to welcome you to the Fisher Files. This is episode 11. And today's topic is time scavenging and multitasking. So, I'd like to talk about how we use our time today, specifically how we try to do several things at one time, and how to chase down odd little bits of time. And I think this has important consequences, because I think frequently it has to do with how people view us. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. First, I'd like to talk about a little bit about how the brain works. And some of this comes from an article that I read recently, which I'll post in the program notes. And there have been some things about this in Science and Nature over the past couple months. But the picture of the way the brain works is the brain does actually many things simultaneously. Unlike a computer, it's very massively parallel, so that we have a whole range of involuntary things that the brain takes care of while we're doing voluntary things. So, for example, the brain regulates respiration and heartbeat and blood pressure and walking and even eating while we talk and watch television and sometimes do both at the same time. However, your brain has an executive control center, which is called the executive center. And that is really directing where the focus of your attention is. And the paper I'm just mentioned studied basically how long it takes people to switch from one task to another. Because in fact, you never really carry out two tasks at the same time. You switch back and forth. And you may be able to switch back and forth very quickly, but in fact, you are switching back and forth. And what prompted some of this research was had to do with cell phones while driving. Now, obviously, talking on a cell phone is a bad idea while you're driving. And one concern was that you would have your hand, one hand off the wheel while you're yapping into the phone. And presumably you also have that hand off the wheel when you're dialing, and you're also looking at the phone, and then there's the whole business of getting the phone out of your pocket and purse. And the early concerns about a cell phone dwelt primarily on the physicality or the physical aspect that you were losing part of your control of the vehicle because you had a hand or a shoulder devoted to the cell phone. However, there was an early study done, I think by the Saab people, that indicated even with hands free, your ability to control the car did not improve much when you were talking on the cell phone. And the primary outcome of this is that you are distracted when you're talking on the cell phone, and to a degree where even it doesn't really matter whether you're holding the phone in your hand or not. The primary thing is the distraction of your center of attention. Now, you might ask that why this doesn't matter when you have people in the car and you talk to them, and they don't distract you that much when you're driving. There was another, I'm not sure it was a study, but there was another paper I read that looked at the distraction caused by somebody sitting next to you, talking to you, and a child in a child seat in back. And automatically, it seems, when you talk to someone while you're driving your car, when you come to a point where you need to devote more attention to your driving than to the conversation, it seems that people become aware of this either by observing the situation directly or noticing that you're becoming momentarily distracted and stop talking, which, of course, small children are incapable of doing. And anyone who's tried to navigate through downtown Boston with a kid yapping in the kiddie seats knows exactly what I'm talking about. The underlying reason for this is that your brain focuses on one thing or the other. The brain focuses either on driving the car or on listening and participating in a conversation. And it switches back and forth. The paper I mentioned measured the switching time. And for familiar tasks, the switching time is much faster, well below a tenth of a second. But if you're switching between a familiar task and an unfamiliar task, the switching time can be quite a bit longer. So when you're talking to someone who is not stopping talking, when they become aware that you're distracted and place a demand on your attention, your executive center gives them that focus, or tries to, and tries to deal with that attention either just by, you know, telling the kid to shut up, or actually listening and satisfying the demand and then switching back. The bottom line is something like driving a car is a complex enough task that it is not like walking or breathing or running. People can run for long periods of time while carrying on conversations because it's a very automatic thing to do. Driving a car isn't. And so the real thing is the distraction that causes you to switch your attention away from driving the car and switch it back when the other task is finished. This, to me, is very familiar, and not just from driving, but also trying to do other things. And I'd like to propose that you think about this carefully, because very frequently people try to do two things at once. And the most extreme forms of multitasking are, for example, sending email and working on your laptop during a talk, or watching television while trying to study or read a book, or trying to carry on a conversation while you're driving. Basically, trying to do two things at once. And my experience has become that most times this really doesn't work. And it's really not possible to do two things at once. Now, the interesting thing is that this has become much more prevalent because with wireless computer networks and laptops and Palm Pilots and cell phones, it's now possible for us to take all of those things to places where normally, or 10 years ago, we wouldn't be able to. And this creates the impression that one can recover time by carrying out perhaps even mundane tasks, for example, during a seminar. I maintain that if you're doing something on your computer during a seminar, you're not actually listening. You may be filtering for some series of keywords that are of interest to you, and upon hearing those, you may stop what you're doing and pay attention to the seminar, and that's the switching aspect. But I think, in fact, DC, you're either listening to the seminar or you're doing whatever other thing you're doing. I think in a seminar, this is probably a little bit rude. If you have time to go to the seminar, I think you should probably go and listen to the seminar. But that's just my opinion. Another interesting place where this comes up is in meetings. It's become very common, particularly for larger meetings, for example, collaboration meetings, for people to come and sit and listen to the talks and bring their laptop and type away on their laptop, and not actually really be listening, but being physically present and creating the appearance of interest. I think people notice this, and I think people notice whether you're paying attention or not. So it's important to think about what you're really trying to convey when you go to a working group meeting or collaboration meeting or panel meeting or something like that, and spend your time working on something else. Now, for example, during a lecture, an academic lecture, I think really you're doing yourself a terrible disservice if you're not paying attention. I mean, after all, why else would you be there? Most professors don't really care whether you're actually there or not. And if you're really that busy, you might want to think about just going and doing whatever it is you need to do, you know, by yourself and not in the lecture room. Coming back to meetings, I've actually seen this create a problem. I was just recently in a meeting where, you know, we all had our laptops, including me. You know, I've got to check my mail, just like everybody else. But we had a very long, complicated discussion about something we wanted to do, and we were finished and gathering up our things. And not one, but two people who had spent the whole time messing around on their laptops stopped and said, "Wait a minute, I didn't understand what we decided." It wasn't that they didn't understand, they just didn't hear. The entire thing had to be discussed again. And during this time, one of them started up on the laptop again and wasn't listening. So using your laptop is really something that's going to take 100% of your attention. And you should just recognize that. This might change even with age, because I think 5 or 10 years ago, when I was writing a program or something, or debugging a program, I could easily listen to music or, you know, news broadcasts. And now I just find it terribly distracting, and I can really only do one thing at a time. I shut off the music or the news broadcast, and that might be an age thing. The most egregious times this happens is during phone meetings. So many of us now spend significant amount of time on the phone, on a conference call with many people, other people connected. And because we all have computers and web browsers, slides can be distributed, and everybody can look at the slide, and the speaker can give a talk, and it's almost, well, not almost, but it's supposed to be like we were just there. What I think happens in probably about 50% of the cases is people who aren't speaking mute their phone, put the slides up sort of in one corner, and are working away at something else, and again, not really listening. This is fine if what's going on is not very important to you, and you want to create the impression of interest. But if you're actually trying to get something out of the talk, I would suggest that you should probably really pay full attention. I know it's hard, because one of the problems with a computer is that it's a very demanding thing, in the sense that its mere presence makes you want to use it. But I think it is good practice to just watch something on your computer and not be trying to do something else. All of this is sort of generated or guided by the fact that none of us feel we have enough time. And there are these tools available that are supposed to help us. And in fact, I don't think they really help us in the way we think they do. I think they really sort of allow us to choose when we do things a lot more. But I think in the sense of saving time, the computer has not really done it. It's just changed the way we use time. My view about being an academic, and I've said this before, is that our job is really very, very much centered around personal interactions and conversation, listening, or giving talks. And that sort of during the workday, at least for me, that's got to be my top priority. And for that reason, I really don't take my laptop to meetings or seminars or things like that. I've kind of worked out a system that if I need to really work on a program or write something or debug something, that I do that alone in my office with the door closed and without so that I'm not bothered or interrupted. And I really try to do that in the evenings when after my family's in bed. Because during the day, it's just much more important to be able to talk to people directly. Now, there are techniques for recovering time, and it really sort of relies on a little bit of organization and planning. One does spend a lot of time during the day waiting for things, waiting in line to get coffee, waiting for an airplane or a bus or some sort of transportation, or actually riding the transportation. Sometimes you just find yourself someplace where you have 5 minutes that you didn't expect to have. And that's where having your daily file, all the little things you've got to do that day, and your reading file is a valuable thing to have. And if you have all of your organizational stuff on a PDA, waiting in line at the bank, for example, is a very, very good time just to go through your waiting for list, through your someday maybe list, down the list of your projects to make sure you're current and have something planned for each one of them. Go through your to-do list, lists, and cross off things that you've done, add things. This is really not multitasking because you're not doing anything except waiting, just keeping your body physically somewhere. Or you're on hold. This is also a good time to do stuff like this. And you're just using that time for little daily maintenance tasks. If you seem to have longer time than having your folder of things to read, particularly they're kind of I have kind of two categories of things to read, actually three categories. I have scientific publications, and I try to keep up on those, and I tend not to read those when I'm time scavenging, simply because they require more concentration than you can usually give, leaning up against one of those banisters at the airport. Then there are the magazines, Science, Nature, Physical Review, and time scavenging is actually pretty good to read a lot of the things that are in there because many of them are pretty short. I also get like the APS News and a bunch of stuff from the MIT Technology Review, the faculty newsletter, a bunch of things like that. Those are great to read. It's low grade stuff. It's kind of stuff that you should know and try to keep up on, but isn't, particularly important or timely. And just being able to, for example, go through the faculty newsletter in 10 minutes while I'm waiting for my wife somewhere, and then I can just drop it in the trash, and that's done. Also, having your think folder of things to do that day, and you can write checks, you can check on bills, things like that. That's really distinct from multitasking because you're recovering time that's useless anyway. So that's really kind of all I had to say on the topic. I think the message really is you want to think carefully about multitasking in a public place because people really notice whether or not you're paying attention, especially if you're a speaker. At least I do. And if you're not paying attention, my understanding is that you are choosing not to pay attention and that you're putting whatever it is that you're doing in front of the talk or the meeting or whatever thing you have hauled yourself to go and sit and listen to or participate in. And it's really just kind of saying, I think that, you know, I'm going to leave my body here because that's kind of what's expected of me. But my mind is really somewhere else. And so you may think about that and choose to do it anyway, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm just trying to say that people really do notice. And time scavenging is just a valuable skill to develop, and is well worth it. You can probably, if you work hard at it, squeeze out an hour or two a week. Articles that I read. One is in the most recent Science, and it's about type 1a supernovas. Type 1a supernova is thought to be a white dwarf, which is kind of a failed star. It has less mass than our sun, and it has some other star or white dwarf in orbit around it. And it's sucking material out of that object with its gravitational field. And so it's accreting material in this disk. The disk is from the angular momentum of the accreted material. And as the white dwarf gains more and more mass, it reaches the Chandrasekhar limit, where it can no longer support itself with radiation pressure and begins to collapse, triggering fusion and of the hydrogen, and then a supernova explosion. Now, the idea, one of the central ideas of the new cosmology, is that there are very simple relationships between the total light output of a type 1a supernova and its brightness. And it's not simply that they all have the same brightness. They are not standard candles. But there is some model that relates the duration of the bright glow of the supernova with the total light output. And by using semi-empirical normalizations, it's possible to determine the light output independent of the distance by looking at the duration of the light in different frequency bands and then applying some correction or stretch factor. This technique was employed by several groups. All of them found that distant type 1a supernovas, these are a redshift of 1 and greater, so when the universe was half as old as it is now, what was found is that these appear dimmer, and this is one of the major pieces of evidence that there is dark energy in the universe. Now, recently, there was a meeting that was reported in Science about exploding stars, and one of the major things that was discussed and came out of the meeting was that both simulation and observation indicate that the relationship between the light output and the duration of the light output may not be so clear. The simulations sort of indicate that the whole star doesn't go nova at the same time, but instead somewhere on the surface, fusion begins, and it spreads along over the surface and then leaps out and engulfs the star in rather a complicated way, but can lead to a rather asymmetric supernova explosion. the bottom line to all of this is that the people interviewed, including Bob Kirchner, really sort of stopped short of saying there was a problem, and that you could not use Type 1A supernovae as standard candle. But the experts did seem to say that there was a lot that wasn't understood, and a lot of further work was needed. This was particularly interesting because this is a time when several large projects are headed towards NASA, specifically to count supernovae and increase our understanding of the cosmos by measuring the equation of state of the dark energy more precisely. In a related matter, Paul Schechter sent me a paper written by Simon White, which is really about the new relationship between astronomy and particle physicists in the context of the planned very large survey experiments like SNAP and LSST. And I mean, I've seen these kind of articles before, and they're always interesting. I think basically Simon White's problem is that he sees astronomy as this incredibly diverse field where there are people who are working on cosmology and compact objects and the microwave background and comets and planets and extrasolar planets and a whole lot of other things. And what he's afraid of is that the big move to these survey instruments and large area surveys is going to create a situation, make astronomy like particle physics, where there are very large facilities and only a few really fundamental ideas that are being pursued. That perception is not entirely accurate. I mean, clearly there are a set of 4 to 7 questions that are the most central of particle physics. And I think if you polled particle physicists, they'd sort of agree on most of them. So it's not all that restrictive. But where I did understand and was sympathetic is that in particle physics, if you're not working on one of those 7, I think you're really just not on the map. For example, if you're doing meson spectroscopy, that's really viewed as second or third class. And the kind of simple systematic program of measurements is something that, at least to me, is really gone from particle physics. Certainly people do them, but it's always dressed up in the context of, oh, we've got to understand the mass of the Higgs, or we've got to measure CP violation in systems with all these final states, so we have to measure them. Simply measuring and cataloging is something that is not appreciated in particle physics, and it is in astronomy. Really, one thing I think I'm beginning to understand about astronomy is that a big part of it is just looking at what's out there in the universe and using physics to try to make some sense of it, but also just cataloging it as something that was observed with a certain frequency, which can be come back to later. And these are really the places, I think, where, number one, there are surprises, and number two, where individuals can really flourish. Like Atlas, I don't really see how anyone is going to make much of a name for themselves in LSST, but individuals have been making names for themselves in things like studying extrasolar planets and comets and solar physics and things like that. And I think that stuff is still very much appreciated by the astronomical community. So the larger question of whether or not letters like Simon Thwaites are valuable or change anything, I'll leave aside. I think it's very valuable to read them and think about them for yourself, and really try to always be thinking about whether or not you're where you want to be and headed in the right direction. That's it for this week. Remember that, you know, when you multitask, you're saying something, and make sure you understand what you're saying, and that people understand what you're intending to say. Next week, I'm going to have a kind of a summary of the 12 or the 11 episodes to date, and talk about where we go from here. And until then, I'd like to thank Sheila Marston and her husband, John, for all the help and inspiration. And Sean Thompson and Maynard Galinas at the LNS Computational Facility for providing disk space and hosting. And Bonna Newman and Homer Reed at REFS. And I'd also like to note that today was really the first spring-like day in a long time. And I hope it continues. Certainly improved my mood. So that's it, and I'll talk to you next week. And until then, enjoy your work and research in Cambridge or wherever you are. Without a reason, I could have loved you. Without a care, I could have given you all I had to share. Could have loved